Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. A year into the pandemic, what have we learned? More than we ever thought we'd want to know about infectious disease, who's good at puzzles and who isn't, patients, and which of your friends, relatives, and coworkers are really, really technically challenged. Oh, and the importance, more than ever, of accessibility to fast, reliable, and affordable internet. So very much. Today in Congress, the Accessible, Affordable Internet for All Act will be introduced. Part of that is the Broadband Expansion Bill. Having worked on it in the Broadband Task Force, Representative Peter Welch is the person to turn to learn what it's all about, and he joins us now. Congressman Welch, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you.
And listeners, if you want to ask Representative Welch about the Accessible, Affordable Internet Act, you can call us 244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Congressman, how great is the need for reliable broadband service throughout the country?
It's existential. I mean, you can't survive, especially in rural Vermont, in rural America, unless you have high-speed, reliable internet. And, you know, I'm the head of the co-chair of the Rural Broadband Caucus. And I've worked with a lot of my Republican colleagues, and just before COVID, you know, a little over a year ago, we were making the case for rural broadband. It was a show-me kind of response from many of our urban colleagues. They just didn't believe it was that big a deal. Well, with COVID, as you said in your introduction, it's absolutely existential. In Vermont, if you don't have reliable internet, you're a small business like, say, Jasper Hill Cheese, you can't sell your product. If you're a kid who's at home, it's not just about doing homework. You can't go to school unless you have high-speed internet. And medicine has increasingly depended on telemedicine, which requires high-speed internet. So for education, for healthcare, for business, whatever your enterprise, including farms, you absolutely have to have high-speed internet. And rural America has been discriminated against, largely because the big providers, they really don't have a reason market-wise to serve us, and they don't care, and they stick us with high bills and bad service. So there has to be a role the government plays, much like it did with electricity in the 1930s, where we said, hey, we're going to get that electricity out to that last farm on that dirt road in Glover or wherever, and we have to do the same with the internet. And I think we're going to do it. That's the good news. We're going to do it.
Well, you've used a term before, digital divide. Explain what that is and the effects of, especially of those who are on the wrong side of the digital divide.
Well, let's use the term electricity. Let's say you had 60% of Americans had electricity and 40% that didn't. Let's say you had high-speed internet in urban areas, but none in our smaller towns in rural areas. It would mean that the opportunities that were available where electricity in the earlier case or internet now, those would be broad and expansive, whereas those without access to high-speed internet, their kids are going to fall behind, their businesses aren't going to flourish. And, of course, in Vermont, where, you know, we want folks who are going to start businesses and create jobs to come here, they can't do it unless they absolutely can count on high-speed, urban-style internet. So that's the divide. It's a haves and haves-not situation. And, of course, you know, with COVID, there's been great work in many of our local communities of citizens getting together trying to create essentially cooperatives.
Right.
And and that's what happened with electricity. You know, you get neighbors and towns coming together, then their focus is on the well-being of the people there. And it's not a political thing. You know, whatever your political point of view, you need internet. So this, the Connect America Act that I've introduced today, for $80 billion is, I think, going to be a huge boost. And it's going to be part of our overall internet approach. I also introduced a bill to have Wi-Fi on our buses. You know, that's really important for kids going to and from school. And in the COVID package, you know, the American Rescue Plan, there's going to be $100 million that goes to Vermont for capital projects, and that can include internet projects. There's a lot of tools that we are now going to have to work with, and it's going to mean that Vermont leadership at the local and state level is going to have the resources that are essential to the build-out of broadband throughout Vermont.
Well, with the new $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, there is money in there for broadband build-out. So why isn't that enough? Or why can't we just say, okay, that's taken care of now?
Well, it's not. And the fact is that, you know, how much it costs, the estimates vary quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that you've got to get Vermont connected in rural Vermont, as well as some of our cities that don't have great internet service. Number two, you know that the big carriers really don't care. They don't have an economic incentive, so they just won't do it. Number three, you know, citizens who live in those communities, the businesses and the individuals, have a huge stake in the well-being of their kids and their businesses, and they will. And now this legislation is going to provide some resources to begin that long, and by the way, very, very challenging process of getting local communities wired where the variability in the challenge is extreme. You can be in a part of Vermont that has lots of hills and Northeast Kingdom up and down, where you can be in parts of Vermont, maybe Addison County along the lake, where it's flatter. But the challenges, the practical challenges, are very variable. So we need local leadership, but local leadership also needs resources.
So, Congressman, tell us about this bill you're introducing today and what it will do, and what it'll mean exactly for Vermont.
Well, it'll be part of a broadband infrastructure bill, but what it would include is money, $80 billion. And that would be for the purpose of assisting communities throughout America to get the high-speed internet that their communities lack. And I use the term future-proof because there's been a lot of talk about getting better service to rural communities, but not service that has the capacity to keep up with technological improvements. And we don't want to build a system that is better today, but it's going to fall behind tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We want to be building systems that can accept whatever technological progress is made, similar to how that's the case in our big metropolitan areas. So it's a money issue here. But then the second, as I keep emphasizing, is there's got to be good local leadership because I think the local leadership is really what gives me the hope that this will be money well spent. Because if you're a community group that's getting together with several towns, and we've got many of these in Vermont, everybody in that group is totally preoccupied with getting high-speed internet where they live for the people they serve. That's not the case with the big carriers. You know, bottom line for them, quote, shareholder value, profits. And if it's not economical or profitable for them to get out into Danby, Vermont, or Victory, Vermont, they're not going to do it.
I'm thinking, and I'm going to sound old, and I think Danny, our director, probably wasn't alive when this happened, Congressman, but I'm going to say about 1995, a friend told me about something called the internet and the World Wide Web, and I rushed to his office to watch as he downloaded pages. I could get scores from Australian rugby league, and each page would take like 5 minutes maybe to download. Do you remember this?
That's right.
Yeah.
I do the dial-up. Yeah. And then you lose the call. No, all this has happened very quickly. But, you know, let me give a concrete example. You know, Jasper Hill Cheese up in Greensboro, which is an incredible success story.
Right.
When COVID came, they couldn't have people up there. They weren't able to sell their cheese in restaurants anymore. It really hammered their market. Well, they were able to start an internet sales operation, and they had in Hardwick, and they it saved them. And just think about what would have happened to this wonderful company, Jasper Hill Cheese, that we're so proud of, if they didn't have access to internet to sell their product, and all the of the impact that would have had on the local economy, the folks that work there at Jasper Hill, the farms that are supported by that. So we absolutely have to have it. And by the way, this is a unifying call. You know, my rural broadband caucus.
Yeah,
we've got as many Republicans on it as Democrats, and our advocacy is for the people we represent who have the same need for high-speed internet. And I find that working on an issue like that, where the benefit is to our citizens and our businesses, regardless of whether they're in a so-called red district or a blue district, it creates some potential for the unity all of us in this country know we need.
And let's take a call from Plainfield. We've got Nick on the line. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Congressman Welch. And thanks so much to DEV for this program.
Sure.
Well, first off, I just want to say thank you for your leadership on the ARP Act and the PRO Act for our unions and working people. So really appreciate your leadership there. Really exciting to hear about this act. And I was curious, you know, how you'll support the skills and learning necessary for people to benefit from increased broadband access. I think there's the physical benefit of having more access, but what about the skills and training so we can make sure that Vermonters can actually take advantage of that access? Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you for that. There's two aspects to your question, at least as I understand it. One is, our kids need the internet in order to develop skills and get a good education. You can't have it without it. You know, I was up in Gilman, Vermont, a tiny town. It's been struggling, a wonderful place. They've got a great superintendent up there in school. And those kids don't even have it on the bus. And so I think, number one, internet is essential, like books are essential. In order for kids to learn. So that's a very big step. The second is, with respect to getting the skills, what I've observed is that kids are really good at it in terms of mastering how you use the technology. You know, Rick was talking earlier about how he was feeling older. Well, all of us are older compared to the kids because they are born into a world where they and their peers learn how to use this. But there's a third issue maybe you're talking about that I think is really important, and that is the quality of education and the STEM, you know, the science, the technology that we want our kids to have opportunities to excel in. And much of that, I think, is going to be the responsibility of our local school boards, who, incidentally, under the COVID Relief Act, the American Recovery Act, are going to be getting substantial sums of money to help them reopen our schools and return to in-person learning. So that's my view. I don't know if I hit exactly what you wanted, but thank you for that question.
He may have been asking, too, you know, we talked about digital divide a little earlier, and it's, you know, those who have high-speed internet, those who don't, but it could also be those who have the skills to even use it. You know, we assume everyone, once they get on a computer, knows what they're doing, but that's not necessarily the case. Some have grown up without computer, haven't had the internet available to them, and you know, how do they learn those skills?
Right. Well, I, you know, that's where it's a hands-on. That's what's so vital about our teachers. Mm-hmm. That if the teachers don't have the tool and the kids don't have access to the tool, the internet, then obviously they have no chance of learning those skills. If they have, then the internet, it's like having books. Then our local teachers are going to really be the ones I think that we're going to have to rely on, as we always do, for improving those skills for our young Vermonters.
Representative Welch, we've heard this so many times about getting broadband to the last mile and every mile throughout the state. So will this bill, will this be the thing that will do that?
I think it will. I do. It's, you know, this is a huge country with lots of geographic variability. And the actual getting it to the last mile is about the urgency of getting it into every home and every business. We did it with electricity, okay? And it was literally the same type of dynamic. What happened is that we made a political decision in the 1930s. It wasn't an economic decision. The political decision was, you know what, we're not going to abandon rural America. And we should never abandon rural America, because my view is that those of us in rural areas, we contribute so much to the well-being of this country, including the values. I mean, when you think about Vermont and the participation rate in public service and military service, you know, Vermonters since the Civil War have played an outsized role in sacrificing for the well-being of our country and our democracy. So we can't turn our back on what rural America has to contribute. We didn't, because we made that decision in the 30s under President Roosevelt that, you know what, we're going to wire America. Mm-hmm. And now under President Biden, we're finally making progress, and we're going to get broadband to all of America.
Let's take another call. We'll go to Danville this time. We've got Ryan on the line. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, good morning.
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 Just a quick question. I worked in this industry, you know, the cable industry and stuff. And the last time we had this, hundreds of thousands, million dollars were given for companies to build out to the rural areas. I don't know if it was after 9/11 or what it was, but all they did was overbuild places where there was already internet. It was just like a big waste of money. I mean, like, they'd build downtown St. Johnsbury, which already had two service providers. It just seems to me that they would have to take the competition for customers out of the equation so that, you know, they're not fighting for dollars mm-hmm. with the customers. I mean, that's...
Well, you know,
you have... Touché,
Ryan.
Well, you know, Ryan, you've got a really good point, okay? Because we need resources. We know that. But we've got to use them wisely. So if what you're doing is building where we already have internet instead of building where we need internet, that's blowing it. That's wasting money. So I'm in solid agreement with you on that. So, you know, job one, if we get the funds, like this $80 billion that I think we need, then job two, and it's really, really a hard job, as this money comes, let's say, into Vermont, how do we make certain that it's going to be wisely used and for the benefit of Vermonters, and the net result is going to be that we don't have duplication, but we have high speed everywhere. And I actually have a good deal more confidence this time around, because there's so much more citizen awareness and so much more citizen involvement in this effort, and Vermonters are pretty tight with the dollar. But I just want to acknowledge that you are making, I think, a very valid point, and we've got to be super vigilant to make certain that what you fear doesn't happen.
Well, has there been any idea of how you will coordinate with the states, with these local communities and their efforts that are going on currently?
A lot of thought, but there's an infrastructure that's developing here. First of all, as you know, the governor and the legislature are really focused on this, right? And they have Ryan's concern. Number two, what we've seen developing in Vermont are some of these internet districts where a number of towns get together to work together to accomplish the build out of high speed internet throughout their towns. So number one, his point is correct, right? Let's use the money wisely. Number two, we have to have local leadership, the state in legislative level, but also at the town level, where you can have confidence that the people there are focused on the people they serve in their towns, as opposed to a big provider that basically has first, second, and third consideration how much money they make for the shareholders.
Now, I know you have to leave in a couple minutes. You have a vote coming up. And I did want to ask you about the COVID relief bill, $1.9 trillion approved by the House and Senate going to President Biden now. Some of the criticism, though, Congressman, is it's too much. It's puffy, and it's not all going to COVID relief. So how do you respond to those criticisms of that bill?
Well, this bill is necessary. It's ambitious. And here's what's really unique about it. The help is going basically directly to citizens. I mean, $1,400 checks, if your income is $75,000 or less, the $1,400 check to the dependent, if you have a family of four, and you're making, say, $100,000, you're going to get $5,600. And folks need that right now. So the money is going to people who need it. Number two, we're transforming child care policy in this country by helping parents. And if you have a child under six, you're going to get a $300 a month check to help you with those child care expenses. And by the way, that's really helpful to women because they've borne the brunt of child rearing and the pressure that has been imposed on families as a result of COVID. Right. Kids have to be home. And as a result of that, many women have had to drop out of the labor force. Mm-hmm. It's going to take some of that pressure off. Then there's money that goes to the state. It's going to have to be used wisely by Governor Scott in our legislature. Money to our school districts that need it to help deal with the expenses associated with reopening. And money that goes to our local towns. Every town is going to get a check. And that means local people, our local select boards and citizens are going to have to figure out how best to use that for the long-term benefit of their community. So, you know, it is a big bill. But I want to put this in a contrast. This is a big bill where it's helping people in towns directly. When President Trump did his big bill that added $2.3 trillion to the deficit, it was tax cuts for pharmaceutical companies and for the top 1%. So, you know, this is investing in America, investing in our families, investing in the internet, our schools, as opposed to tax cuts for the wealthy. So I think this is going to pay dividends, and I think it's necessary.
All right. I've got to let you go. If I don't get you to that vote, they'll never let me have you on this show again, and I got to have you back. So I appreciate you being here.
Well, great to be with you. I very much appreciate being here, and I appreciated the questions from your listeners.
All right. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. That's Representative Peter Welch, and he joined us. He's got a vote to go to, and so we're going to take a break for CBS News. We'll get an update from them, and then we come back with Mark Isselhardt. He joins us for the sweetest of all discussions. That is maple syrup. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Zingari. Temperatures have never meant so much to me like they do now at this time of year. Knowing when the temps are climbing above and then below freezing is massively important to about every fourth person in Vermont who either owns a sugaring operation, has a sugar bush on their property, or has a neighbor who will be boiling and in need of help over the next several weeks. This is the Vermont I've come to know, and I've come to know it with the help of great instructors like Mark Isselhardt. Mark is a UVM Extension maple specialist and host of the Vermont Maple Minute. Mark, it's great to have you back on Vermont Viewpoint.
Happy to be here.
And listeners, if you've got a sugaring question or if you want to report how the sap is flowing where you are, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And Mark, let's start with how the season has gone so far. I know it's early days.
Yeah, it's been an interesting one for sure. There are, depending on where you're located and how large your operation is, you may be started tapping back in 2020. We had producers who were tapping in December And some of that's a function of how big they are. They have to get them all in time for the regular sap flow. Others can be more responsive to the short-term weather and maybe just finished tapping. But then you have to have the weather, and believe it or not, it's not just the first time it goes above freezing that you get sap flow. You need to have a kind of a conditioning period where the trees start to thaw out. So I guess the long way of saying it's started. People are making syrup, but it's not necessarily gushing yet, although some places will have good runs today. There's a lot of snow in the woods, and until you start seeing that snow pull back from the base of the trees and you really get some good thawing, not just the exterior of the trees or the small trees, but it takes a while to get that system really up and running. But the season is definitely underway. 2021 syrup has been made, and folks are right at it.
So in a week like this, where we're going to spike into like the 50s, maybe even the 60s, does that signal to the tree to shift into spring mode? Or, like you said, it's just kind of thawing out, and it'll be all right when we just have those, you know, up and down over freezing mark?
Well, the trees definitely respond to the environment they're in. So they will accumulate a certain amount of warmth over time, and that will trigger a lot of things that aren't even visible from the outside, but there's a lot of signaling. It's pretty complex and fascinating, but the tree will start to exit dormancy, and it does take time. You need an accumulation of heat, and you need the photoperiod, the longer days of light. It's not necessarily related specifically to sap flow, but the tree is making its way out of dormancy. It's breaking down the compounds that keep the tree dormant. Obviously, it's not a good strategy as a plant to break bud the first time it goes to 60 degrees. That would be bad, because we all know it's going to freeze up, and that would be damaging to the tree. So there are some natural processes within the tree to have it be a slower process, not just reacting to the first few days of really warm temperatures.
And because of climate change, we've heard, you know, about the season kind of getting earlier and earlier. So, you know, as soon as I think about it, oh my gosh, it's, you know, they're putting in the taps. It's sometime in February. It's sap season. But traditionally, that's not really true. Sap season tends to start in Vermont about when, and how much has that shifted, say, over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years?
Right. So we have seen an earlier and earlier start on average, and we've seen the ending coming a little bit earlier. And overall, the duration has been compressed roughly by about 10%, I'd say, over the last 30 or 40 years. Mm. Now, of course, there are going to be individual operations that have seen more change than others, but that's basically the duration. However, you know, anyone who's ever tapped a tree knows that sap flow isn't this steady process. You tap it and you get sap day one, and it runs steadily until the season's over. It's made up of these really distinct sap flow events, these runs of sap. And you can have a short number of days from the beginning to the end and still have a really good season, depending on how that weather plays out during that start and finish. So a combination of that and technology, we've seen yields going higher over the last period of time, even though the duration, things are starting earlier and ending earlier, and overall they're shortened by about 10% in terms of days.
All right.
But yields have been steady or climbing, actually.
And Mark, on those perfect sap flow days, and that's, you know, again, when the temps go back over 32 and, you know, during the day, freeze at night. And I'm guessing that's during the day is when, we see the sap flow, right, when it's warmed and it's over freezing.
It can be, yeah. I mean, although you can get big runs when things really loosen up, you can get big runs at night if it doesn't freeze. I think one of the best ways for people to understand how variable it can be is, you know, drive on a dirt road on one of those days where it's just warming up, and you can see those little pockets where maybe it's protected by some hemlock or some other conifers, and it just looks like midwinter, frozen, rock solid. And you come around the corner, and it's mud, you know, and so that the trees and the sugar bush respond in a similar way. If they're a little protected, if it's a northern facing cold pocket, they're going to respond differently than someone, even just a neighbor with a more southerly facing operation. So yes, the temperature is really important, but it can be very, very localized. And the whole system is really driven by the fine branches up on the top and then progressively down to the larger parts of the tree. But the fine twigs are the first things to react because they're smaller in mass. And so they can respond more. But if the trunk isn't thawed out, especially down at the base, then there's nowhere for the sap to be drawn up and stimulate that sap flow.
And for a city boy like me, Mark, please explain what is exactly going on in that tree that has this sap flowing that we're stealing from it to make the wonderful syrup.
Yeah, boy, it's really a fascinating process. And there's a combination of physical attributes, physical attributes to the tree, so how the wood of the tree is designed and built, as well as some more chemical-type reactions that are happening. So at its most basic, you have a tree that's made up of a dense collection of very, very small straws that are allow water to move from the ground all the way up to the twigs. And that system is designed primarily for the growing season when the tree is photosynthesizing. Mm-hmm. But those same pipes that conduct all that water during the growing season every day are the same pipes we're cutting into with a tapping bit and collecting some sap. So maple is unique, not alone, but it's fairly unique in that it has sugar-enriched sap in the spring. All trees will try to replenish its water ahead of the growing season and bud break, but sugar maple has a pretty sweet sap. And so we also have this period of sap flow that's stimulated by this fluctuation between a negative pressure situation in the tree and positive pressure. And that, that is triggered by this freezing and thawing. It doesn't have to be during the day and night, but most often it is. Mm. And as that tree that has thawed out previously, like I said, it doesn't start gushing the first day it goes above 32, but assuming the tree has been thawed out and is what we call conditioned, when it freezes, those fine branches freeze first. And depending on how it freezes, if it's a long, slow freeze to a cold temperature, that's at best because you get this massive uptake of water from the ground because they're connected hydraulically, even mm-hmm. though it's not just one big long straw, but they are connected. There's a pathway. And so if you have a nice, long, drawn-out, cold freezing event, and then the next day or whenever it thaws again, you have this massive amount of liquid that's been drawn up. And when it thaws, you get this combination of the gases that have been compressed during that freezing event. They start to expand. And that forces sap out. Plus, you have this huge amount of liquid that's been drawn up, and you have this volume of sap above the tap hole. And if you have a bucket, it'll run as long as it's above freezing and there's liquid above. If you have vacuum, you get all that sap, plus you get some flow that's stimulated just by the differences in pressure because you're sucking sap on it. So, yeah, I'm sorry. It's a bit of a long explanation. But,
I don't care.
It's a fascinating thing.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Mark, once the sap starts to flow, can we still tap the trees?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yep. The limiting factor is really the end of the season when either the sap quality is degraded to the point where it doesn't make a good product and doesn't have any value for either the homeowner or in the market, mm-hmm. or the trees just stop giving sap. You know, once the buds break, the tree goes from essentially a consumer of its stored energy to a producer. Once those buds start to unfurl a little bit, the whole system changes and it goes into the business of making more sugar. So, yeah, you might miss out on a run or two if you were to not have tapped yet, but there's no reason if you're curious about the process and have some trees and some willingness to learn some of the details, There's no reason you couldn't go out and tap a tree and make some syrup.
What is the best way to tap trees to get the highest yield?
Well, again, it kind of depends on what your goals are. If it's going to be a project with a family at home, or if you're looking to draw some sort of income from it. Essentially, we want to make sure that we're tapping the tree in a sustainable way regardless, but the equipment you use might be different depending on what your goals are. But essentially, you want to make a nice, clean hole in the tree. We recommend using a tapping-specific drill bit rather than a general-purpose hardware bit, just because it tends to make a cleaner hole and you get a better yield from that. We also want to make sure that we're tapping trees that are generally healthy, and you're tapping into good conductive wood. The tree will respond to any wound, a tapping bit or maybe a lawnmower banged up against it or some other kind of damage by walling off that injury. And if you tap into that stained area, you'll get very little or no sap out of it. So you want to make sure you're looking at the whole tree, finding a good area where there's clean wood, which can be difficult because there aren't a whole lot of clues from the outside. But you want to make a hole and have some sort of container to collect the sap. It is important to remember that we are talking about a food product, and if you're collecting it in something that isn't a food-grade material, you want to be really careful about that. So there are buckets out there that have lead, and we want to make sure that people are collecting sap in a safe way and boiling it down, because a lot of the materials that could be in there get concentrated. So something food grade, and then get ready to boil because there's a lot of water in the sap and it does take a while. So make sure you're anticipating how much fuel you're going to need. And we have a lot of resources on the UVM Extension Maple page for people who are just getting into it, and also for advanced sugar makers. So happy to point people in the right direction if they want to learn more.
Is there a correct depth to drill that hole into the tree?
So generally speaking, we would recommend anywhere from 1.5 to 2 inches deep. If you keep going deeper, you're going to make a larger area of stain and non-conductive wood, but you're not going to get that much more sap out of it. And if you go really shallow, you'll make a small wound, but you may not get the highest yields possible. So the balance point is somewhere, 1.5, 2 inches deep, and that includes the bark, which can be variable for sure. Some of those big roadside trees could have 1/2 inch or more of bark, depending on how it is, but somewhere in that range.
And, Mark, I don't want to rush along the season, but when it is time to remove the spouts, when and how should that be done?
So generally speaking, you want to do it right as the tree is done giving sap, because the tree, like I said, once the buds break, the tree goes into the business of making sugar for itself, essentially for reproduction and for new growth. And it will begin the process of healing over the old tap holes. The tree doesn't fill in that hole that you drill, but it does cover it over with a new year's growth. So if there's a spout there, it won't cover that over until the spout's removed. So it's a good idea to remove it. Functionally speaking, the tree is already internally walled off that tap hole. So if you don't get to it until, a few weeks or so or more after, that's okay. There isn't a magical date that it has to be done, but as soon as possible is best practice.
All right. Now, you've charted maple syrup production in Vermont. So how has it varied over, say, the last century?
Wow, it's a really interesting story that really mirrors Vermont agriculture. You go back 100 years ago, and we were much more of an agricultural economy. And there was just about as many trees tapped back 100 years ago in the early 1900s as there are now. The difference was that those taps were spread out over many, many farms rather than focused on a smaller number. And so we saw from that high point we saw a pretty steady decline, which coincides with the abandonment of many of the smaller dairy farms across the state. And then you get to kind of a low point, maybe in the late 50s, early 60s, where there was still quite a bit of syrup being made, and those would be dairy farms that are still in business that also have sugaring or just sugaring-specific operations. And that kind of plateau at the bottom continued for many years until really around the late 80s and 90s it started picking up a little bit, and then we've seen a very noticeable increase in production over the last 20 to 25 years. Mm-hmm. And now, so we're almost back up to where we were 100 years ago in terms of production. It's just who's making that syrup and where that's changed.
What has led to that resurgence, you know, like 80s and 90s?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors. Probably can't get into it in too much detail, but I'd say it's a combination of improved technology, increased marketing at the international level of getting people who've never had maple to try it, and definitely the impact of Canada and how they, Quebec specifically, markets their syrup. They have a government-sanctioned supply management system up there where, given that they produce 70% of the world's syrup, they have enough market share that they can really maintain production and supply and essentially set the price. And there are times when that's favorable for U.S. producers and Vermont producers, and there are times when it isn't as favorable. So the one thing I do want to say, though, is that the quality, you know, has been the same. The regulations really haven't changed a huge amount as far as the quality. The names have changed and such, but Vermont adopted maple regulations very early on, and so the importance of quality remains the same over 100 years.
And we only have a couple minutes before the break. Do you have time to stay a little bit after 10, or do you have to get going?
No, I'd be happy to.
Okay. The one other question about this is the yield per taps. Has that changed much through time?
It has. You know, the old adage was about a quart of syrup per tap per tree. So, you know, that might equate to roughly 10 gallons or a little more of sap per tap. We've seen that increase over time, and I think you can attribute a lot of that to the use of vacuum and tubing, and sort of the improvements in terms of technology collecting sap and better leak detection, people taking a little more care with making sure that all the leaks are good, and pumps that can pull higher levels of vacuum. You can still tap with buckets. That technology works the same as it always has. But if you're in the business of maximizing yield, generally speaking, it's going to be a tubing system and vacuum.
All right. We're going to take a break. Mark Isselhart is a UVM Extension maple specialist. He's the host of the Vermont Maple Minute. And after the top of the hour, we get him for a few more minutes, and then he's got a skedaddle. So if you've got a question, you can get in the queue now, 244-1777. 877-291-8255, and then we're going to head to CBS News, and then the 10 o'clock hour, the remainder of that, we will have open phones. So again, if you want to talk about any other subject other than sugaring, that'll happen about 10:15 until 11 o'clock this morning here on WDEV's Vermont Viewpoint.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall-winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. UVM Extension maple specialist and host of the Vermont Maple Minute, Mark Isselhart, has a few more minutes. So if you've got a question or comment, you got to get in now, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Mark, I guess as we start to boil, are there specific safety concerns that you like to point out to people when they start to boil?
Well, I mean, there's certainly, if you're dealing with fire, you know, there, you want to be careful there. And depending on your operation, you may have a really big evaporator. You might have a small little wood fire. But either way, you know, just personal safety is important. The issues with food safety are, you know, maple is considered a low-risk product. You know, not without any risk, but the production of it is fairly safe for boiling the sap. But there are specific regulations that maple producers have to follow, and those are laid down in both Vermont law and regulation and federal regulation. And it's important that producers understand what those are and follow them. So if you're selling syrup in the marketplace, you need to meet, you know, those standards, and producers should understand that there are folks checking. The Agency of Agriculture is empowered to check retail syrup. So you want to make sure that you're following those regulations if you're selling syrup, and just not to waste the product too. If you don't boil quite enough and it ferments, you've wasted a lot of time and energy and money, and so try to acquaint yourself with the best practices, and even if you're not selling it, it's a shame to have all that hard work be lost because you didn't quite boil it enough, or maybe the sap wasn't good quality when you're about to boil. So when you get into larger operations, you know, we start talking about equipment that has potential risks, and you know, there are some chemicals used to clean reverse osmosis machines that producers need to be careful of, you know, following good personal protection when they're handling those materials. So there's a real strong imagery of maple production that's rooted, you know, kind of in the 19th century and early 20th century. But that's still holds true, but there's also a very modern aspect to maple production, and it's important for folks to be aware of that.
All right, let's get a call in here before you go. Larry joins us from Montpelier. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Some few to several years ago, there was some research being done, I believe, by UVM on tapping small diameter trees. It would have been kind of a funny looking orchard with, you know, a lot of one tap and thousands of three or four inch trees. But I was wondering where that went.
I do remember that. Thanks, Larry.
Yeah. Thanks for the question, Larry. You know, so that work was initiated by Dr. Tim Perkins, Dr. Abby Vandenberg at the Proctor Maple Research Center. I was involved a little bit, but it's really their experiment. And it definitely captivated people's attention. And what's happening now is we were able to prove the concept and run some numbers on what you might be able to produce. And the system does work. There just aren't any commercially available fittings to make that connection. And so I believe right now they're in the process of refining an actual cap or a fitting that could do it. I do know that people got pretty excited back then, and some actually put in small saplings and are cultivating those in anticipation of maybe having some fittings available. So the research has been done for the most part. I think the next stage would be something that a producer could actually buy and not have to fabricate themselves because, like you point out, it's a pretty different looking system for sure. Not at all what we're used to. So getting an affordable fitting that would allow you to connect and be vacuum tight, that's really important. Mm. These small saplings, you might think in your mind, are perfect cylinders, but when you really look at them, they're oblong and they've got little bits of bark and cracks and stuff, and it's hard to make a good vacuum tight seal, but it doesn't kill the tree. The tree just resprouts similar to what we had in the ice storm back in 97, 98. A lot of those trees lost a big part of their crown, but the tree's dormant buds flushed and it grew a new crown, and it's pretty amazing how adaptable these trees are to something so catastrophic as having the top cut off.
And I remember they were looking at something very similar with apple production as well. And so I know that's out of your realm, but I think UVM or Cornell or both were looking at that. Okay, last question. Is it syrup or syrup?
Definitely maple syrup. Yep.
Syrup. Yeah. All right. I think until I get the pronunciation correct, I'm never going to be a true Vermonter. I still say syrup, which is what we say back in Pennsylvania, but here in Vermont, it's syrup. All right. Mark Gislehart, I want to thank you so much for being on the show again today.
Well, thanks for having me, and good luck to everyone out there. If you're tapping just one tree or thousands, best of luck in the next few weeks. It's going to be exciting for sure.
Absolutely. We did get a call earlier, and yesterday we had one of the first women to receive the Eagle Scout Award, and she goes to St. Mike's, is from New Hampshire, and is attending St. Michael's College. And so earlier, this one of our listeners left a message that her two sons are Eagle Scouts, and one of them got a job flying jets for Warren Buffett's company because he was an Eagle Scout. So loved hearing that note and a follow-up on our discussion yesterday on being an Eagle Scout. So that was one thing we got in. And unfortunately, Amanda, got your questions for Congressman Welch a little late, and I was really focused on the Internet Act. But I will shoot these questions over to Congressman Welch, and hopefully we'll get some answers for you. And Amanda asked a couple questions and said, any momentum on a wealth tax that Senator Warren, that's Elizabeth Warren, has proposed? And the other question was, can you update Vermonters on student loan forgiveness and actions that will come from the latest stimulus bill? So I will shoot those over to Congressman Welch, and hopefully, Amanda, I can get you some questions. I might be able to relate them on the air, but if not, I will email them back to you, the answers that I get from Congressman Peter Welch. So thanks for sending that. Unfortunately, I apologize that I wasn't able to get that asked on the air while he was with us, and he had a pretty tight schedule. He had a 9:30 vote, and Mark Gislehart originally was supposed to be on 10 to 11 today, and he's got to testify I think the legislature, something on probably maple sugar production. And so, and I'm sure that's by Zoom. But anyway, they both were on kind of tight schedules today, but I really appreciate that they both did make time to be on. I hope you make time to give me a call, 244-1777. Toll free outside of the Waterbury area, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. Now, yesterday we had a caller named PK, and she said she liked when I just talk. And now Danny, the director, is rolling his eyes like, oh no, he's going to talk and talk and talk. And so I knew that I had time to fill today, and I decided that when you don't call, I'm going to pull out a poetry book of a Vermonter. His name is Herbert Elliott, and I think he was a farmer over in St. Jay, and his daughter, Sandria Elliott Ebbett, selected the poems that she found that her father had written, and I decided that I would share some of them with you. I hope I don't have to read too many. Reading poetry is a little different, and I love when poets do it. They really know how to have the certain lilt and accent to reading poetry. But in the introduction, let me just tell you a little bit about what she says about her father. So he married June Hall, who he had met at the University of Vermont. They bought a small farm on Diamond Hill. This is a mile west of his parents' place in St. Jay. And his drawing of that farmhouse appears on the cover of this beautiful little book, this poetry book that I own. He began farming with about 12 cows and a small flock of turkeys. He milked by hand, cultivated strawberries, made maple syrup. How about that? Picked vast quantities of wild raspberries and blackberries, which my mother canned. During the war, he worked at the shipyard in Portland, Maine, and he and my mother had three children. In 1950, My parents bought a larger farm lower on the flanks of Diamond Hill. The new farm with more cows and a larger turkey business meant more work. By the mid-50s, they were raising as many as 1,000 turkeys per year. He wrote no poems about turkeys. I love that note. He loved American antiques and frequented auctions and antique shops around New England. In his later years, he wrote a column for the Linden Independent, usually recalling events from his boyhood. Throughout his life, he was a close observer of animals, wildflowers, trees, and stars. And she writes, after my father died in 1990, my mother asked me to take care of his poetry. For more than 10 years, I couldn't bring myself to look at his poems, although many of them were familiar from my childhood. A few years ago, I began to reread them. I sorted them into categories and was about to put them in a box under the eaves when I started to wonder how many lifetimes have been stuffed under the eaves. And she says this project followed, and then she actually decided to have this book printed with her father's poems. And so they're divided into different chapters, and this is from Falling Star, and I'll read a few for you as I wait for your calls. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. All right. The first poem I'll read to you, and this is Herbert Elliott. And again, I am not great at reading poetry. I'm not great at understanding poetry, but I will say that reading his poems made me feel even more connected to Vermont than I do. There are twin butternut trees, I know, that clutch at time with lifestyle boughs, but many and many a year ago, they throve on the hill above the house. Many a season ago they died, then lingered lifeless side by side. And men who scuffed in autumn gold to gather nuts before the cold have gone as trees, and men must go, have gone in quietude like snow. Fingering the wind, a dead tree stands, reminding one of vanished hands. All right, that's the first one from Herbert Elliott that I'll read. And again, our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can share poetry, either of what you love or that you've written, or maybe you knew Herbert Elliott if you're from the St. Johnsbury area and have some stories to share about him. And like I said, we'll talk just about any subject you want. We can talk about the need for internet. We talked to Congressman Welch earlier about the bill that's being introduced in Congress today, and that is $80 billion worth, hopefully to reach rural America, reach rural Vermont with high-speed internet. Also, you can talk about sugaring season. We heard from Mark Isselhart. I would love to hear who's tapping right now. Maybe you're in the sugar house and you're boiling. It's not easy, though. You'd have to really turn the radio up, I think. The boiling gets pretty loud out there. Maybe you have the neighbors over, and that's how you pass the time when you're out there. Like I said, it's Women's History Month. If you've got a woman in history that you really revere, I mentioned yesterday that Irena Sendler, who had lived in Poland, my all-time favorite woman in history, and what she was able to accomplish, saving the lives of 2,500 Jewish children from the ghetto in Warsaw. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. The less you call, the more I make PK happy, who loves listening to me talk. And let me see. The next one I'll read to you from Herbert Elliott is called The Lights. When I go out into the dark to walk by smoky lantern light, on either side along my path I see twin candles in the night. In branches of a gnarled old tree, in thickets to the left and right, my small friends come to stare at me and watch me passing in the night. And so I walk by owl and coon and fox and rabbit in its fright, and see their steady burning eyes like holy candles in the night. That's one of my favorites that he's written. That's Herbert Elliott, who was a farmer in St. Johnsbury, And while I wait for your calls, I'm going to read a little bit of his poetry. Really does capture the life we have here and in Vermont. Now, think about this. He probably wrote these in the 50s and 60s, and they still resonate in 2021. They remind us very much of the Vermont that we still have, especially in most parts of the state, especially in the Northeast Kingdom, where Herbert Elliott was from. And I figured out last night as I was reading this that I have been here 18 years. I have now been in Vermont for about 30% of my entire life. And when I think about how much of my life I've lived in that 30%, it feels like more like about 70 or 80% of my life because of all the wonderful moments and people and things I've experienced in this state, in this wee little state of Vermont. All right. I'm talking, you should be calling 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And, we are, let's see, you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, is, how you reach us with your thoughts or, whatever you want to talk about. And I've suggested some topics, and if you don't call, I'm just going to find another one. I do have a lot marked in the book right now to share with you. This isn't supposed to be the Rick Zingary Poetry Hour. This is Vermont Viewpoint, and I love to hear from you. So give me a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. So this book of poetry by Herbert Elliott in different sections. And this section is called Falling Star, and this is actually the poem called Falling Star. So I'll read this one for you, as you're dialing, of course. I saw a star shoot down the night, burning the sky with sudden light. Hurled for aeons through the dark, it blossomed in an instant spark, and ended a billion years of flight to blaze 1 second in my sight. Yeah, anyone who's walked out on a beautiful starlit night here in Vermont has experienced that. And to think, wow, that star just giving me that little show. And that was a really beautiful one called Falling Star. Herbert Elliott is the poet that I'm quoting here while I wait for your calls. And we got a lot of time to fill today. So please call in 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Love to hear what's on your mind. And we're going to go to Ann in Burlington in just a moment. Hold on. We do have Ann lining up on the phone in a second here. So, all right. We ready to go, Danny? All right. Let's try for Ann. Hey, Ann. How you doing?
I'm well. I just thought I'd give you a break.
Thank you. And our listeners.
Well, you know, it's a different voice, but it's I was very happy to hear the poetry. Thank you.
Oh, good. Did you know Herbert Elliott's poetry?
No. I'd never heard of him, but now I want the book. So
yeah.
I'll have to look for it.
Okay. This book is called Take Your Last Look.
All Take right. Your Last Look.
And
all
I,
right.
I don't think it's published heavily.
So, no, probably not, but it's amazing what you can find when you look for it.
Yeah. I wonder if our friend over there in Plainfield has it. He might have a book like this. But, Ann, what else do you want to talk about today?
Well, I don't know, because I just turned on right after your just the tail end of your maple speaking, and my father owns a farm, but we stopped sugaring long, long, long ago.
Where's that farm?
It's right across the river from town, the Harvey Farm there, where the horses are.
Oh, okay. So, nice. Have you lived in Vermont all your life?
No, actually, I moved to New York City for 20 years, where I worked in the music and theater business.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there's not much to tell. I didn't become famous, but I did make a living, so I was happy with that. And I don't really know that I wanted to be famous. I just wanted to work. So I worked at Riverside Shakespeare Company and some And I did. I've actually done a lot of work around Vermont. Well, in Vermont, people would know me from Lost Nation Theater or from the Skinner Barn, where I've done some things. And they probably know me from the free winter concerts or the free Christmas concerts in Waterbury at the White Church.
Oh,
I've been producing those for a while. So I'm hoping we can get back to that next year. We didn't have one last year.
No kidding. So, I agree.
Just putting it out there to all my singer friends and musician friends that hopefully we'll be able to do a real one next year.
I know. And so. I've watched some performances, you know, streaming and, you know, downloading them. And it's great to have those arts available. But, boy, mm-hmm. there's nothing like live theater and being sitting there in the arena, sitting in the theater there, is there?
Yeah. Although we at Lost Nation Theater, we were able to do a reading with some of the professional actors around the area, donated their time, and we were able to do a stage reading on the Capitol steps last fall, and it was great. We had so much fun. We had a nice audience, probably more than the 100 we were supposed to have, but I wasn't counting, so I'm not. Like to say that didn't work out, but we didn't have any COVID outbreaks, and we all had a great time, and we raised a little money for the theater. So that was fun, and I'm looking forward to getting back to it.
I loved when I lived in Montpelier, and I would walk in on like a Wednesday or Thursday night. I could just walk in and go to Lost Nation Theater. And I'm going to tell a story after the break. I'm just going to keep on talking, but we're almost at a break. I'm going to tell you a story, so keep listening. I think you'll enjoy it, about Lost Nation Theater right after this break. We're going to go to CBS News Update, back with more poetry and open phones. Listeners, you can hop on the line, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value. Generous, full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
All right, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and this hour is yours. It's all yours. Unless you don't call, then it's mine, all mine. And I'm going to keep reading the poetry of St. Johnsbury poet Herbert Elliott, which I really love. You can share whatever you'd like this morning, thoughts on the need for internet access, maple sugaring updates, some poetry you love. Our numbers, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Heard from Rich over in Starksboro, who enjoyed the segment with Mark Isselhoff this morning. He said, I appreciate that I got a second opinion on the pronunciation of maple syrup. Sorry, I have a hard time saying it that way. I grew up saying syrup, which is how we say it back in the area I grew up in. The process of maple production, he writes, has gotten more and more complex in the last 20 years or so with the advancements in technology and knowledge gained from research. In December, the Vermont Maple Sugar Maple Association had a week-long conference on maple practices. And Rich provided a link. There's videos on the sessions. So if anybody's interested, you can go to vermontmaple.org and then /maple-conferences. But vermontmaple.org, you can look for that if you're interested in seeing what's there. Rich says it's pretty interesting stuff. Now, before the break, I was talking to Ann. And Ann, a theater buff, a performer, went to New York City for a while, 20 years, and was in theater there, has done Lost Nation Theater and others here in Vermont. And so I want to tell you a little story about Lost Nation Theater. So I used to be able to walk into town when I lived in Montpelier on, you know, say like a Wednesday night, which is a light night for theater. And sometimes I'd go to the Savoy when stuff was playing there, or I'd go see a show and it'd be a new show at the Lost Nation Theater. And it was a brand new production. As a matter of fact, I think it was written locally, and directed by a gentleman named Tim Tavkar, which I'm sure a lot of people in theater in Vermont know, Tim Tavkar. So I show up that night, and I go to I always sit alone. So there's people, you know, as you come in, there's a stand here and a stand there, and then there's a stand all the way over there, and I go sit in that, and no one else does. So it's just me sitting there. And I shave what little hair I do have, so I'm mostly bald most of the time. I'm sitting over there by myself, and as the person comes out to kind of tell you about that night's performance, she starts to talk and tells you about I think it was Piaf was the I think that was the performance I was at, and says, and it's directed by Tim Tavkar, and with her left hand she motions to where I am, me sitting by myself in these stands all alone, and I'm thinking, for sure somewhere behind me up in like scaffolding or something, Tim Tavkar must be, because she's referring to Tim Tavkar. And so at the end of the performance, as I walked out, people were congratulating me and telling me how much they enjoyed the performance of this play. Me, who is just a ticket-buying person like they were, and I realized, oh, my God, they think I'm Tim Tavkar. Thinks I'm Tim Tavkar, who directed this wonderful performance at Lost Nation Theater. So years later, I'm working at a radio station, and I hear that Tim Tavkar is in the building, and I rush to find him and say, I got to tell you my Tim Tavkar story. You probably didn't realize there were Tim Tavkar stories, but that was it. And all right, I'm just going to stop because we're going to Sharon, and we've got Roger. Hey, Roger, how you doing?
Not too terrible, in yourself?
I'm great. Great to have a caller. What do you got?
Well, I have a favorite poet, David Budbill.
Oh, yes.
And he's influenced by the Chinese and has a little haikus. I've got a couple here if you want to hear them.
I do. I want to hear. Go right ahead, David. I mean, Roger. It's David Budbill.
Yeah, that's
you
me.
Love. Yeah. Please.
Okay, here we go. This is On the Road to Buddhahood. Ever plainer, ever simpler, ever more ordinary. My goal is to become a simpleton, and from what everybody tells me, I'm making real progress. Which I think is a good one.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, yeah. David Budbill. Do you have another one for us?
Sure.
Please do.
This one is a short one, too.
Okay.
Try not to look like you're on the path to somewhere. That way nobody will ask you where you're going. And he also has the book Jude Vine, which is which is just great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's fantastic. Roger, I really do appreciate that you share that, the works of David Budbill. The second one kind of reminded me years ago, Roger, I had known a woman whose last name was Dull, and I was making my first trip to Scotland and noticed that there was a little village named Dull, Scotland. So I decided I was going to go. And it was, you know, one of these one-track roads going in and out, you know, hedges lining it. And you get there, and there was a church and six homes, right, in Dull. And I'm snapping pictures. And a DHL truck pulls up. It had come up from Edinburgh. And the guy hops out, and he can't find the address he's looking for. And he asked me, this stupid American, no idea. And I'm trying to look like the guy in the second poem, like you don't know where, not me, I don't know. But he asked me, I had to tell him, nope, sorry. So I hope the package got delivered. But, hey, Roger, thank you so much for sharing those David Budbill poems. That was really
great.
You're
welcome.
All right, take care. All right. All right, that's Roger, and we're going to go now to Montpelier. We've got Stephen. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, can you hear me?
I can, yeah. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just want to mention that many years ago, when I was a student, I went down to New York with my history class, and we visited with Eleanor Roosevelt. We had lunch with her in her apartment, and she was really a delightful person. And earlier, she had delivered the commencement address at the Putney School. When she lived in New York, she came over and gave that address.
Oh, my goodness. That is fantastic. Is that where you went to school, to Putney School?
Yes, for my high school. Yeah, for, it was a boarding school at that time.
Uh-huh.
Still is, actually. It was a farm school at that time.
Wow. So how long were you in the presence of Eleanor Roosevelt?
Well, we just had lunch with her in her apartment and with a history teacher and several other kids from my class.
And that's like American royalty, right? A former first woman. So were you at all nervous,
right,
or?
No, it was just a delight. She was delightful.
Wow. That is so great. Did you get to ask her questions or?
Yeah, we had a great, all kinds of questions.
Yeah. Do you remember what you asked?
And her husband. No, I don't. It was a long time ago.
Oh, wow. Stephen, that's fantastic. Meeting Eleanor Roosevelt. So about what year would that have been?
That would have been probably 1963 or 64.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And Hyde Park in New York was like...
That's where she lived.
Right. Is that where you met her? But you met her in New York City.
New York City. She had an apartment in New York City.
Gotcha.
And then she came over from Hyde Park before I went to the school,
right,
to deliver their commencement address when... Carmelita Hinton was still the director.
Oh, my goodness. What a treat. That is a great story. I'm so glad you called in with that. That's why we do these open phones. We just don't know what we're going to learn. And have you ever been to Hyde Park? Have you ever stopped there?
I have not.
Yeah, nor I, but I heard it's wonderful. I used to work with a gentleman who loves going to presidential homesteads. And so he rates Hyde Park as one of the best to go visit. So maybe post-pandemic. That's my favorite phrase.
Yeah,
post-pandemic. Yeah. All right, Stephen, hey, thanks so much for the call.
You're welcome.
Oh, man, two great calls. Learning about hearing some David Budbill poetry, which was fantastic. And Stephen, who had had an audience with Eleanor Roosevelt. Love that so much, back in 1963. In New York City. A couple sports notes I should mention. Do you know we're less than 2 months away from the start of Thunder Road? Early May is when Thunder Road will be back. So, wow, getting close. And Danny, the director, mentioned this a year ago is when we had the shutdown, the NBA shutdown. And we knew that was so major, especially if you're a sports fan, that a league would just say, we're shutting down, that the pandemic was a real thing and it was really happening. I had attended a concert. I was back home visiting my mother, and on this Thursday night, I was at a concert, and it was one of the former members of Genesis. They were doing the whole Selling England by the Pound album. And it was just heady, and, you know, you kept hearing about the virus and what was going on. And on my way home on the radio, I heard that the NBA had decided to shut it down. And I thought, uh-oh, I think this thing is serious. And indeed, a year later, we know how serious it is. All right, so that's a couple things. We're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And in between calls, I am reading from Take Your Last Look. It's the poetry of Herbert Elliott, a farmer and poet from St. Jay. And this is from First Hepatica, which is the next section in the book. And I want to make sure I read this one because it's called March Night, and we are there. Here we go. The night is full of windy sound, and frozen pools are spiked to ground with stars, but spring is at the edge of things. A bluebird came today. He sleeps within the whistling hedge. His song at daybreak ought to start the blood pent in the maple's heart. And I'll give you one more before I give you phone numbers again. This is called Birds With Us. I was just chuffed. I'm not a great poetry person. I've probably never written a poem of any note, but as I went through this book, I did notice an ABABA rhyme scheme. You think you're such a poet, Rick. All right. Actually, it's Herbert Elliott. This one's called called Birds With Us. The April snow came late and covered bush and weed. Around the house in flocks, the spring birds came to feed. The woodbirds left the woods and snowy forest floor and printed little tracks before the kitchen door. The night came and the moon, and in the silver gleam, in barn they dreamed of spring on rafter and on beam. Still Vermont. It's still Vermont. He probably wrote this, what, 50, 60 years ago? I'm sure that people are saying, hey, Frost, same thing, Robert Frost. You read Robert Frost. Yeah, I get it. Great poetry paints an image that's eternal. I really like this. His name is Herbert Elliott. You probably never heard him. It's a little book called Take Your Last Look. His daughter had it published, and I don't even know how many there are. It took me a while to find it. Somebody like Galway Connell or someone had mentioned Herbert Elliott, and that's how I found it in the first place. And, well, it got his seal of approval. And so I started to read it and just loved it. All right. I can keep going with poetry, but I'd love to hear from you. Wrap up this hour with some thoughts, some feelings, whatever you like. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I've thrown out a lot of topics, and we've gotten a few. Really loved hearing Roger reading David Budbill and Steven's story about meeting Eleanor Roosevelt. And we heard from Anne, who went off to find, not even necessarily fame and fortune, but to follow her her love of theater, and did last 20 years in New York City and then came back and has been in theater here in Vermont. Really great stories. And remember, I'm always looking for great guests, and I love when you step forward and suggest them. A lot of people do email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com and suggest. And, you know, I do try as many as possible to get on. I really want to introduce you to the places of Vermont, the people of Vermont, the businesses of Vermont, as much as I can. And, of course, the politicians and the issues that affect us every day here. Really important. And I'll do my best on that. All right. 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And I can always tell when there must be some desperation in my voice because Rich, my superhero from Starksboro, likes to swoop in and help me out and carry me away. He wears a cape. Hey, Rich, how you doing?
Pretty good, Rick. And you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Well, I just want to let you know that I'm going way out on my comfort zone, but it's got to relate to poetry. I kind of have the same experience with you with poetry. I don't read it that much, you know, like kind of like you said. But the only piece of poetry I know is comes from my the wedding certificate of my great grandmother and grandfather that were I believe they were married in Weston, Vermont in 1895.
Oh my.
And we have the certificate, and at the bottom of the, it's like a ceremonial certificate. It's not the real one that gets recorded in a town clerk, but
right.
It's at the bottom, there's this poem, and I recited the poem to my wife at our wedding, and then I recite the poem to her every year on our anniversary.
Man. You're going to make me cry.
Well, you know, now I'm really thinking about that too. I did that at the wedding.
Oh, I shouldn't have said that.
I got in trouble, but anyway, I'll let it go. We'll see what happens.
All right, please do.
You'll understand if it doesn't go right.
So, all right.
Anyway, there comes a day when love that lies asleep, the fairest island in the mighty deep. There we stay a while, but soon again we trim our sails to seek the open main. And now, whatever wind and waves betide, two friendly ships are sailing side by side.
Hmm. Oh, Rich, that's beautiful, and you did it perfectly. So, yeah, you know, I think of there is a song by Supertramp, and there's a line in that song which reminds me of the side-by-side imagery that you have in that poem. And the line is, just as long as there's two of us, I'll carry on. Yep. And right. And it's just that simple. You know, the two ships sailing side by side, it's just that simple. Sometimes to express, you know, the deepness of love. So hard to figure out, so hard sometimes to put into words. And then somebody does. Do you have any idea, who wrote the poem? It wasn't one of your grandparents, I take it.
No, I think it's something that came with the, you know, it's like a stock certificate, and it kind of had this stock poem at the bottom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well, I just...
And we'd be 39 years we've been married this coming August.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, not too bad for us, I guess.
Oh, I love hearing that. That is really great, Rich. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I got just one thing to...
Please,
I wasn't going to call until I got this... Got the thinking about this poem. I thought about 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, about the one tap, what Mark said, you get one tap per we'll give you a quart of maple syrup.
Right.
He got the number of gallons wrong. At 2% concentration of sap,
mm-hmm.
It would take 10 3/4 gallons to make a quart of syrup, because it takes 43 gallons at 2% sugar concentration.
Gotcha.
To make a gallon of maple syrup. He probably said that. I didn't catch the beginning of the show, but anyway,
right.
Just thought I'd mention it. It's, you know, it's hard to do these calculations in your head.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, so, it is. So I just always say 40 to 1.
Anyway, but I just wanted to correct it for the audience.
All right. Thanks, Rich.
Yeah. Okay. You take care now.
All right. You too. Have a beautiful.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, Rich always swoops in to save me. All right, that is our show for today. Now, tomorrow, we're going to be talking about our forest land. That's what we'll start with for the first hour. We'll go on to national news, and then we'll hear about the recent Burlington mayoral race and, oh, crap, mammoths. I cannot wait. Tomorrow at 10:30 to 11, we will be talking about mammoths with a professor from Dartmouth College. Yeah, I'm pretty excited for that. All right. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. Remember our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Write in, suggest topics, guests, and you can also listen to past episodes. The lost episodes are lost. Past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint, you can download them at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio is up next with Bill Sayre. I'm Rick Zingari. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.